家好，欢迎收听北美台湾研究学会 NATA 这一季的 podcast。 这一季的主题是 Old Books in Taiwan Studies。 我们希望透过每一集的 podcast 重访一部台湾研究中的经典作品。每一集我们会访问一位学者专家，请他分享一部他觉得对于自己研究或者台湾研究中重要的一部作品。我们的对话会围绕在这部作品在这门学科中的影响力，对我们语台人的影响。我们也会试着讨论这部作品值得深化的议题与概念。我们希望每一集的 podcast 可以是一个契机，让一本旧书得以再次被重访。我是以琳，这一次加入主持的还有志华。我们这次访谈的对象是台湾大学国发所助理教授 Liv Nachman， 他选的是 Joseph Wong 的 Healthy Democracies, Welfare Politics in Taiwan and South Korea。志华，你对这两位学者跟他们讨论的议题比较熟悉，你要不要分享一下这次跟他聊天完后的心得？
好，谢谢雨林。那各位好，我是志华，我目前是 UC Irvine 的社会学博士候选人。在聊完之后，我觉得就是我有几个点想要就是再回顾的。那第一个是说，我觉得 Lab 的书它很就是回应到了在就是台湾研究的一些新的一些方向。那在政治学里面有一个所谓的词叫 second image reverse， 就是去谈说不只是国内政治影响了国际，但也谈到国际政治如何是受到如何影响了国内的不同国家的国内的政治。那在这样的角度下来理解，就是台湾的contested state，或是面对的就是contestation 的关系，那它也彰显了台湾研究这几年来更跨国与全球的一个走向。那第二点，我觉得也值得去注意的事情是说，那 Lab 的书其实等于是 highlight 了国际政治的对国内的影响，但国际政治也并不会完全主导国内的变迁，那也还要加上其他的 conditions。那包括说民主化，包括说运动等等，所以在这个时候，我们回来重新去看Joseph Wong 的书，去理解说，就是民主化怎么样影响到台湾的以及南韩的社会政策的制定，跟怎么样去开启新的机会，让就是政治的精英可以去影响决策。他可以去从这个方向来理解的话，这些 condition 他在当前我们更关注全球变迁的时候，它还是一个重要的一个因素之一。那我们值得我们再去就重新做回顾。那第三点是在于说，我觉得就是这一些书都去回应了台湾研究的一些方法上的一些类似或更多元的部分。那两本书其实基本上都是关注政治精英。那一方面像 Joseph Wong 的书是讨论的是一些比较建制的民意代表、政治精英等等。那 Lab 的书则是主要谈的是一些 emerging 的这些精英，包括社会运动的一些精英等等。但我觉得，就是这一些书跟这些作者他们后续的一些研究，都也会更去关注到一些台湾的主体，大家的到底什么是台湾，跟哪些人被包含在这个范围里面。那就是大家的意向想要往哪边走，也同时去思考说他怎么样可以去有一些更超越国界方向的切入。那像包括就是不忘他后来更关注到不被社会福利网所包含的一些台湾民众，那包括 Lackman 他谈更多有关台湾的民意在台美关系、中美竞争的框架下的怎么样去的变化是什么。我觉得这些都是许多台湾研究的学者他不只在看到一个变化中的一个社会，但同时也去思考到底从一个更全球、更跨国的角度来切入的话，台湾到底本身是什么的问题。
好，谢谢志华精彩的分享。那接下来让我们来听Nachman 教授怎么谈Healthy Democracies。
Yeah, okay. So, we are glad to have Lev Nachman, an assistant professor at the Graduate Institute of National Development at NTU on the caucus. So, congratulations on your new book, The Contested Taiwan, Sovereignty, Social Movements, and Party Formation. So, first of all, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and say a little bit about your book?
Thank you so much for having me, of course.My name is Dr. Lev Nachman. I teach political science at National Taiwan University. My book is based off of my PhD dissertation, which looks at the relationship between social movements and political parties in Taiwan, but also more broadly tries to better theorize sort of Taiwan's political condition as a contested state. So in the book, I try to talk about under what conditions some social movements try to transform into political parties, which is sort of a classic question in social sciences, whether you're in sociology or political science. But in my book, what I try to do is sort of account for this universe of cases, contested states, and sort of how being contested challenges a lot of our fundamental assumptions in social science theory in ways that we need to sort of either revisit, add additional explanations for, especially with this sort of very classic puzzle of movements to parties. I look at the formation of new movement parties after the 2014 Sunflower Movement and the formation of parties like the New Power Party and the Social Democratic Party, Shi Dai Li Liang and Shihui Min Zudang, and show how there were additional necessary conditions to take into account for why we saw new movement parties form in Taiwan during those years.
Thank you for your answer. I've read a part of your new book, and it's a really, really fascinating project, and I'm looking forward to finish it. And our theme for this year's NATSA podcast is old books in Taiwan studies, and our goal is to revisit some of the foundational works in Taiwan studies and its connection with new research. So you pick Joseph Wong's 2004 book, Healthy Democracies, Welfare Politics in Taiwan and South Korea. We were wondering, could you say a little bit about why did you choose Wong's book? And to your mind, what's the significance of this book in Taiwan studies?
So I picked Dr. Wong's book for a couple of reasons. First, because I think there's simply a really important story about why we have national health insurance in Taiwan and why we even enjoy it so much, because there is really nothing inevitable about having such a strong, robust healthcare system in Taiwan. And what this book does is really takes us through and tells us not just the story of how we end up with this robust healthcare system in Taiwan, but more importantly, how democracy played a role in not just the creation of the system, but also sort of what kept the system in place. And the reason that matters is because in the world of Taiwan studies, we talk a lot about why democracy is good. And we talk a lot about like why we value democracy. But something that I really think this book does is shows like a very real and very important example of how democracy has led to the betterment of people in Taiwan, or has led to policy outcomes that people in Taiwan genuinely want. And this outcome would not have happened, I think Dr. Wong shows fairly convincingly, without democracy. And so, you know, this book is a classic in Taiwan studies for a couple reasons. One, because of the political history that it's able to depict from the late 80s and 90s, but also because I think it contributes an important lesson about why democracy matters beyond sort of this sort of, you know, normative dimension, which of course is very important, but also sort of shows a very real world policy dimension as to how democracy has made Taiwan better.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. So let's dive a little bit into Joseph Wong's book and also the connection with your book as well. So so in Healthy Democracies, Wong basically argues that the democratization legitimizes political competition, compelling newly democratized regimes to pursue the social political reforms. So to compete in this emerging political field, political actors, whether they are movements or established institutional political actors, they mobilize the social economic issues and build coalitions essential to social welfare reform. So the conditions evolving and actors have to learn about the political context, to adapt that and innovate in terms of the policy issues and the opportunities. So Wong emphasized also there's a lag between the introduction of democracy and there's a realization of representations and the participation in the social policy making. So we want to hear a little bit more about your take on Wong's theory, your story 20 years apart, complicate the his theory or provide some kind of like a challenge or an alternative argument.
Yeah, so I think something that Dr. Wong shows that's relevant to my story, I mean, the two questions are very different, but I think we do have an important connection. And the connection is, how does a state like Taiwan, a former authoritarian power that spent decades not really thinking about trying to cast as wide a net of support as possible, but instead only providing goods and services to constituencies that mattered most, suddenly decide to embrace and pursue a healthcare policy that is going to not just win people over, but pursue a healthcare policy that everyone wanted. And when I say everyone, I mean across party lines. So this was a healthcare system that everyone from the DPP, the KMT, and the New Party, which was relevant back in the 90s, everyone was for the NHI program. And as you very nicely summarized, when democracy happened in Taiwan, the KMT suddenly needed to appeal to a much larger base of support. They needed to start winning over constituencies because they are now playing in a electorally competitive field. And one of the ways they're able to try to win people over is through creating a new robust healthcare system. The old healthcare system was broken, needed to be repaired anyway. Dr. Wong has this great statistic in the book where he says like it was broken, and one way to show that is that like 120% of eligible workers were enrolled in the system, which means that there were a lot of people enrolled in the system who were not supposed to be enrolled in the system. So clearly there was already need for a new healthcare system, and the KMT capitalized on this. But what was interesting is that, you know, having this sort of strong welfare state policy for healthcare sort of clashes with what we might have assumed from a former authoritarian government. It also doesn't really match up with what the DPP was advocating for during the Dong Wai era. As Dr. Wong also shows, you know, the DPP advocated for a lot of things, or even the Dong Wai advocated for a lot of things, but healthcare wasn't one of them. These kinds of big, robust social policies were not the meaningful political cleavage or the political dimension that people were feeling was salient at the time. As we know, you know, democracy had much more to do with identity, territory, and what's our relationship with the concept of China. And that doesn't have very much to do with how much money you want to pay to go see a doctor. So the reason this theory connects to my book is because one of the big posits that I theorize is the role of contestation in Taiwan and what it actually means to be contested. And what I talk about in my book is what makes Taiwan contested isn't simply its international lack of recognition or the fact that it's excluded from international organizations, although these are important, but really that Taiwan's domestic politics, the very most important political questions that Taiwanese voters use to decide what they want for the future, is decided by these issues of identity, territory, and how people here relate to China. So the connection between Dr. Wong's book is that, you know, one of the reasons that the KMT and the DPP, two parties who do not really see eye to eye on most things, can magically come together on something like healthcare is because Taiwan was contested, or is contested, I should say. Because Taiwan is contested, and was back then as well, it creates sort of a very odd context in which there's opportunity for parties who otherwise adamantly disagree on everything to come together on something like healthcare, because that was not the main political cleavage and that was not the main point of difference between the two parties. And it's also something that was very popular by this new set of voters. Again, whether or not you were DPP-leaning or KMT-leaning, everyone sort of wanted this policy. And when everyone wants something like this, it makes it very easy for all parties to sort of benefit from passing it. And so, you know, that's what I think, you know, Dr. Wong doesn't use, you know, contested state or this sort of theoretical framework because, you know, the book's written 20 years apart. But I think it would have complemented what he has to say about sort of explaining the conditions in which you have two parties that never really talked about robust healthcare systems before suddenly being able to advocate for these policies.
Thank you for your answer, and it kind of ties really nicely to our next question, and it's also about the idea of contested state and democracy. And you kind of already speak on it a little bit, and especially thinking about the time between when Dr. Wong published his book and your book. And then we're just wondering that this 20 years gap between your book and Dr. Wong's book, and during these 20 years, we see the PRC, the major external threat to Taiwan, has changed its co-optative strategies a lot to decades. So I guess our question is just how do you see the changing strategies of PRC or maybe other external threats to Taiwan kind of play a role in shaping Taiwan's domestic political process, particularly on the formation of social politics?
Yeah, so obviously PRC threats are super important for Taiwan's domestic politics. And this is actually something I spend a whole chapter in my book talking about. The reason it matters is because different kinds of threats, I argue in my book, have different kinds of effects on mobilization. So The kinds of threats we spend most of our time talking about are military threats and rhetorical threats. And these kinds of threats, you know, kind of make sense. You know, rhetorical threats are when Xi Jinping says something mean about Taiwan. Military threats are when there's these large military drills in Taiwan's ADIZ, Taiwan's Air Defense Identification Zone. And even though these kinds of threats make headlines and cause, you know, our parents to worry, they really don't have much of an effect on sort of most people in Taiwan. It doesn't really inspire people to feel scared. It doesn't really stop people from living their everyday life. So instead, what I argue in my book is that there's kind of this third kind of threat, what I call domestic co-optation threat. This idea that when people in Taiwan feel like their democracy is being co-opted, or that they feel like Taiwan's democratic institutions are being used against it, this has an actual mobilization effect. This actually causes people to feel scared and panicked. And this sort of is one of the main mobilization factors behind not just the 2014 Sunflower Movement, but also the 2012 Anti-Media Monopoly Movement, the 2008 Wild Strawberry Movement, and even arguably last year's Bluebird Movement, the Qingyao Yindong, was also somewhat mobilized by this kind of domestic co-optation threat. So PRC threats have certainly changed and varied over time, but what I think matters is, at least for the case of, you know, trying to connect it to sort of social movement and political parties, is when are those threats actually causing people to do something politically? And what I argue in my book is that it really is a matter of looking for these domestic co-optation threats and seeing the mobilization effects that they have.
All right. So moving on from the core arguments and the connection between the books, I also think there is another interesting connection, particularly for our listeners who might be also students or researchers in the Taiwan studies field. It's more about the methodology question. So Wong's book and yours are both comparative politics and based on a qualitative method with small number of cases. And both sort of focus on political elites, whether they are more established, like legislative, or emerging elites, like social movements, activists. So I want to hear a little bit about, like, what's the advantage of your and this kind of methodological choice, and what are some of the limitations? And looking back on Wong's book and also after the publication of your book, do you see, like, what are some of the other alternatives to consider pursuing this kind of research?
Yeah, so when we think about methods in social science and especially political science, it's worth keeping in mind always that the methods should match the research question and not the other way around. So, you know, for both my big question, which is sort of this question about social movements transforming into parties, and also Dr. Wong's question about why would the KMT and DPP both sort of endorse this robust healthcare system, those questions are, as you put it, about political elites. And so what that means is that our data is probably going to need to come from political elites. This isn't a question of public opinion, although public opinion can be helpful sort of robustness checks with what we want to say in terms of sort of it being popular or not popular, or whether people or how people felt about those certain moments in time. But really, the research question begs us to sort of take a qualitative approach. If all we did was show, say, public opinion data or try to use some sort of more statistical analysis to these questions, it might not really be able to answer the question that we have. Now, of course, there's some more novel ways that you might go about doing this kind of research in terms of trying to show that sort of level of trust from the public or endorsement of these systems. For example, like if you wanted to, say, do some sort of survey experiments where you look at different kinds of healthcare system packages to see which people in Taiwan support the most, that might be interesting. But at the same time, we already know that NHI is incredibly popular. So these kinds of quantitative methods might be interesting methodologically, but don't really tell us more about the research question than they need to. So I know in the world of political science, especially these days, we are taught to sort of worship the method before we think about a good research question. But something that I think is worth keeping in mind, especially for these two books, is I remain fairly convinced that these were not quantitative, these research questions did not call for robust quantitative methods, that instead they called for qualitative methodologies.
Yeah, thank you for the question answer. When I was reading Dr. Wong's book, like one thing that really struck me is the qualitative method and how much emphasis he puts on the idea of culture or idea of how ideas change people's behavior, and his emphasis on timing and trying to explain the historical changes of the health policies. So before we wrap up the interview, Could you share a little bit about your current projects and from your old projects to new ones? Could you think of other old books in Taiwan studies that you would recommend?
So I've actually taken a fairly large shift away from my social movement political party research. And the last few years, most of my work has focused largely on public opinion and questions about Taiwan and the United States, and specifically how people in Taiwan feel about the United States and how people in the United States feel about Taiwan. My latest publication that sort of talks about this work just came out in the Japanese Journal of Political Science, which looks at whether or not support for Taiwan remains bipartisan in the United States when the issue of Taiwan is framed in a partisan lens. So to put it differently, when Democrats see Taiwan as a Republican issue, do they still support it? And when Republicans see Taiwan as a Democrat issue, do they still support it? And what I find is some fairly mixed results. So ultimately, what matters is sort of the policy dimension that people are looking at. So if Democrats see Taiwan as a Republican issue, then but specifically along sort of diplomatic policy dimensions, so whether or not we should be advocating for Taiwan in international organizations, that level of support starts to go down. For Republicans, when they see Taiwan as a Democratic issue, their relative level of military support, so whether or not we should be selling Taiwan arms, et cetera, starts to go down, which is a complicated story. It tells us that certain policy issues matter differently and for different partisans. But ultimately, sort of my bigger takeaway is that this common wisdom in the United States that Taiwan is a bipartisan issue and will always be a bipartisan issue doesn't hold. Now, this week, I started doing this research project sort of before there was this sharp turn in support for Ukraine in the United States, where Ukraine also once upon a time was sort of seen as this sort of inevitably bipartisan issue. But as that started to fade away, I felt that this research question was increasingly important. And so I've been pursuing sort of this kind of public opinion research. And this was done doing a series of survey experiments with registered Democrats and registered Republicans in the United States. I've also since done sort of a similar research project here in Taiwan with my two co-authors, Yan Weiting in Academia Sinica, and then Hannah Kim at Sogang University in Seoul, where we're also interested in sort of how support for the United States in Taiwan has changed over time, something that, you know, we're not the only ones keenly interested in, but we're able to show sort of how perceptions of the United States as a trustworthy ally have declined, especially sharply since Donald Trump's second term began. Now all these questions are again, very different from sort of my book that just came out, but this is sort of the direction that I've sort of gone in post-PhD, largely because I'm interested in lots of different topics, and I have so much love for my new book and that project, but very much wanted to switch it up for my own sort of academic interests. To your question about like other classics in Taiwan studies, the two books that I always use in my own class are The Great Exodus by Dominic Yang, and then Becoming Taiwanese by Evan Dolly. To me, still remain sort of two of some of the most important books in understanding contemporary Taiwan politics, because they both sort of take very important moments in time to show the development of sort of the two ends of Taiwanese identity that exist today and how they still matter. So even though they're history books, as a political scientist, I enjoy them quite a bit. And those are still sort of forever the books that I believe everyone in the world of Taiwan studies should read.
Yeah, thank you for the recommendation. And I concur with your choices. Those two books are really, really wonderful. And we are going to interview Professor Dominic Yang in future episodes as well. Yeah. Well, thank you, Lev, for joining us today for this conversation, and thank you for your early insights. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.